The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, who believes that murder and calm do go together. Calm and murder. Here's the year's funniest yoke. You'll have to look it up. Anyway, glad to have you back. Have a great guest today, Bob Burchard, Robert S. Burchard, to those of you who don't know him. And who in the world could that be? Everybody knows Bob. In fact, Bob and I, before we started the interview proper, started wondering how in the world we ever met, and we have no idea. Neither one of us. It's either it was so traumatic or just so blissful that we've both erased it from our memories. As far as I'm concerned, Bob has always been and always will be. He's been an enormous help to me on many of my projects. He's as knowledgeable about film history in general as anybody, and has written some terrific books. One book on Tom Mix, King of the Cowboys, and a book on Cecil B. DeMille. Now, as we discuss in this interview, I've never been the biggest fan of Cecil B. DeMille, and yet Bob's book turned me around to a certain degree and showed me a lot that I'd been missing, and certainly now I can say I'm a fan of the DeMille silent films and selected ones of his talkies. Still can't get on board with Ten Commandments, though. It's just too campy for me. I don't like the campy stuff. Anyway, this is a good interview, and I hope that you will enjoy it. Bob is not only knowledgeable, but erudite, and you gotta love a guy who thinks Green Acres is as funny as I think it is. So with only a minimal amount of ado yet to come, let us welcome Robert S. Burchard.
I was one of those lucky kids, or not so lucky kids, who had a television in the house from the time I was born. A lot of people didn't get them until 1954 or after. But my dad was a ham radio buff and electronics buff, and we had a TV from the time I was born, and I was one of those kids that you had to drag by the ear to go outside and get some fresh air. So I was exposed to films on TV, in silent films, but mostly short comedies, you know, Howdy Doody and Sheriff John and other cartoon or kiddie show hosts would have silent movies on as part of the programming. And so that was the extent of my knowledge of silent film as a kid. My parents were old enough to have gone to movies in the silent era, and when the Robert Youngson film When Howdy Was King came out, my mother took me to the Vogue Theater in Hollywood to see it. I think she felt that it was something I should see. I don't think she or my father had any nostalgia particularly for the good old days, and they weren't movie fans. They might go to the movies once or twice a year to the big roadshow pictures, but they didn't show any great interest in films. But then in October 1961, I was 11 years old, and the David Wolper TV special Hollywood the Golden Years aired on NBC, and I went from being a twist-loving rock and roll brat to a silent movie fanatic. What impressed me was that I had thought that silent movies were short comedies, and suddenly I was seeing clips from what looked like real movies. The King of Kings, Ben-Hur, The Big Parade, things like that, that felt like real substantial movies. And oddly enough, you know, I wasn't a particular movie fan when I was a kid. I can tell you the non-Disney films that I saw, because my parents would only allow me to go to Disney films. In the early days, when I'd go to the movies, I'd get a headache, and so it wasn't really a pleasant experience.
Why was that? Eyes?
I don't know. I mean, once I got to be 11, 12, 13 years old, it was never a problem, but in the early days, it would just be, you know, 4 hours in the theater in the dark. In those days, there were double features. everybody went to the movies differently in those days. You know, you just went to the movies. You didn't go to a particular time. You just went in and then you watched part of one picture, watched another picture all the way through, and then you watched the first one until it got to the point where you'd say, this is where we came in, and you'd get up and leave.
You never hear that anymore.
No, you never hear that anymore. Right. But it was just the way everybody went to the movies in those days.
Now, I remember that. My parents would drop me off at the movies from the very earliest time, like when I was 6 years old.
I was such a good kid, my parents didn't want to get rid of me.
My parents would do anything to drop me off anywhere. And then eventually they would come back. But they would always factor in, if it wasn't a double bill, they'd always factor in how long it would take me to watch the movie twice, because they knew I would want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did that with my brother later on, but with me, I got taken. It was always to Disney movies. As I say, the non-Disney movies I saw as a kid were Don't Go Near the Water and Darby's Rangers, which my mother frowned up when my friend Stephen Duckett's mother dropped us off at the movies to see those. And for some reason, I saw Sergeant Rutledge at an age when I didn't have a clue what it was about, but I have a vivid memory of seeing it, and it must have been on the double bill with some more family-friendly film.
Yeah, that is definitely not a family-friendly, especially in families of, what was it, 1960?
Mm-hmm.
And well, then, not a rape trial.
My parents had gone to see Around the World in 80 Days, and they liked it, and when our neighbors across the street went to see that, they asked if they could take me, and I saw that, and I saw The Alamo, because I wanted to see that, and my premature nod to Frank Thompson.
Well, sure, but it didn't affect you the way it affected me, I'm guessing.
Actually, it was the first movie that I went to see twice, and the first movie that I was aware, because I saw it at, in its roadshow engagement, and then I saw it at the local Montrose Theater, and it was the first film that I was aware had been tampered with. I couldn't remember exactly, but there were certain things that I remembered about it that weren't there, and so it was the first awareness of editing or cutting a film.
Yeah. I never saw the roadshow version until, 1990? Something like that. So, and nobody will ever see it again, because it's lost. It's gone. When did you start thinking that this is something you wanted to look into and do research on?
Well, after seeing Hollywood Golden Years, I was interested, and it was about the time that, you know, many of the stars of the silent era started passing away, and so and there were, you know, shows on TV and comments and papers and magazines. And I started making a scrapbook of silent movie-related stories. I still have the scrapbooks. I think I got up to volume 5 before I stopped. I started going to the silent movie theater. The first feature film I saw was Cecil B. DeMille's The King of Kings in December 1961. In those days, Hampton ran it before the New Year holiday, and later years he ran it after, but... And my mother had seen it in 1927, and I remember her saying, you may not like it, but I did. And then, you know, there were film shows around town, and I remember seeing the Gold Rush billed with Monsieur Hulot's Holiday at what was then the New New Yorker, and is now the New Beverly Theater, until recently the Red Curtains that made it the New New Yorker had not changed all those years.
Well, you were in certainly the right place to see this stuff, because I couldn't see anything except through Castle Films or, no other way in those days.
When Harold Lloyd's World of Comedy came out, which was in 1962, I wanted to see that, and my mother took me to see that, and I, at that time, of course, had never heard of Harold Lloyd, and I enjoyed it, but it didn't bowl me over, and nowadays I say, well, there's a reason for that. It was sort of the best of the worst of Harold Lloyd, in that he ran clips of stuff that he thought of, he couldn't reissue the complete features, and so, but I subsequently saw Safety Last at the Wiltern Theater with Gaylord Carter playing the pipe organ, and that was a transformative experience. It was one of the funniest films I'd ever seen. And then my fifth grade teacher, knowing that I was interested in films, had been to the Pickwick Bookstore, the late limited Pickwick Bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard, and had noticed a book on movies, and she didn't remember the title or the authors, but I persuaded my mother to take me down to the Pickwick Bookstore, and there were remainders of the movies by Richard Griffith and Arthur Meyer for $4.98, and I was fascinated with that, all these pictures, and the text is still, I think, one of my favorite books on movies in terms of giving a broad overview of the history of film up to when it was published.
I think the first film book I ever owned was Immortals of the Screen, and that was it was an interesting experience because I was probably 13 or 14 and had never heard of anybody in the book, but I was fascinated by it and would read about all these people and Hobart Bosworth, who's this? Just, it was such a weird thing to do because there was no outlet at all for me to see any of this stuff.
Well, it's kind of odd. In the major studios didn't start releasing their sound films to television until the very late 50s. I mean, there were a few before that, but Paramount's went out through MCA in 1957. The MGM's went out in 1959, I think it was. Fox about the same time. And it was an interesting experience because nobody had ever been able to relive the past in the way that television made it possible. And films from the 30s look ancient, you know, unlike today where we're used to images from all times and places. You didn't have a chance to look back, except maybe family photograph albums. And it just looked, you know, like from another age.
Mm-hmm.
And so my interest in silent films, because there weren't many books at the time, and most of those that had been written were written around the end of the silent era or just after, there was this nostalgia, a critical nostalgia for the true art of the cinema. And so I sort of turned my nose up at talkies for a while and my new interest in silent films. I remember how that changed, too. I was seeing Singin' in the Rain at Glendale College, and my main interest in that was that it was because it was about that transition. And I said, man, this is a pretty good movie, you know. So I broadened my horizons. Around 1963, there was a book written by Edward Wagenknecht, who was primarily a scholar, a literary scholar, but he'd written a book about his experiences as a young boy and young man as a film fan called The Movies in the Age of Innocence, which is still one of my favorite books. I wrote him a fan letter, and he wrote back and ruined my life by saying, well, you know, you can buy prints of these things from Black Hawk Films. And so I started collecting films. In those days, I mean, I on some of these listservs with silent movie fans, they're lamenting that this film is available on DVD and this one is hard to see, and it was impossible to see anything. It took me 30 years to see the 50 films and classics on the silent screen, and I had to buy a print of When the Clouds Roll By to see that. And so I many of these films I saw in 8mm with no music, one reel at a time on a screen that was about 2 feet wide, and nobody else was interested in seeing them, because it's hard to sit through a 12-reel silent movie with, you know, changing reels every 15 minutes of no music. Because I was here, I was in a church youth group, and I had these 8mm films, and we were trying to raise money for the youth group, so I put together a silent film show, and it included a short reel of Tom Mix and an Arizona wooing. And afterwards, one of the women in the congregation who'd come said, oh, my father-in-law used to work for Tom Mix. And turned out it was Sid Jordan, who was one of Tom's friends from Oklahoma, who came out and worked on pictures. And I got to know Sid very well, and that started my... there's a certain advantage, or there was at the time, in being very young and being interested in this stuff, because most of the people that I met who'd worked in pictures in the early days, everybody had forgotten what they'd done, nobody knew what they were talking about, their children weren't interested at all, and so they glom onto me because I showed some interest. I remember, this is several years later, but I, Howard Green and Joe Adamson had done an interview with Lou Breslow, who had written a number of pictures and had started as a kid actor at Keystone, and they said, maybe you should talk to him, because you know more about his early years. And they said, but he's kind of vague, he's just not quite there. And so I met Lou at a party that they had put on, and we went off in a corner and were talking, and Lou was sort of vague and out of it, and he said, oh, there was a great friend of mine who was killed in a train wreck. And I said, oh, Bill Stoll. He said, Bill Stoll? He said, I haven't heard that name in years. And suddenly, it was as if a light turned on, and he, because I knew what he was talking about, and nobody else did. So, being here, I got to meet a number of people who had worked in pictures. I did get to meet and know Harold Lloyd, Irvin Willett, the director, Joe Rock, the comedian, met along the way and got to know Mary Bryan and Nestor Alston and any number of others.
Did you interview a lot of those people, too? Did you interview Harold Lloyd?
I didn't. I mean, I spoke to him and asked him questions. Harold was an interesting guy. He had written two autobiographies, An American Comedy in 1928, and then Harold Lloyd's World of Comedy with William Kahn in 1964. If the stories were in the book, he could recite them pretty much verbatim. If they weren't, he just couldn't remember. I remember asking him once why The Cat's Paw was released through Fox instead of Paramount, as all his other pictures have been. So, well, I just don't quite remember that. And years later, I found out that Paramount had a first refusal with Lloyd, and they refused, and that's how it ended up at Fox. But he wasn't pretentious in any way, and he didn't seem guarded, but he was well aware of his image, and he had honed that, and that was what he wanted to present to the world. The most fascinating thing to me about Harold Lloyd is he was scoring his films with Gaylord Carter in the last year or so of his life, and I would go over to the place in the valley where they were recording, and I made a point of sitting just behind and to the left of him, so I could watch his reaction. And he was it was fascinating because he really could view the character as a separate thing, and he mm-hmm. would call the boy or the boy with the glasses. He could laugh with the stuff just as we were doing. He wasn't watching himself on screen, he was watching the character, and probably why he was such a great filmmaker was he was able to have that kind of objectivity about what he was doing.
How did you get to meet him in the first place?
The first time I met Harold Lloyd was in 1963 or 65, I guess, at the Wiltern Theater at one of the screenings. I can't remember now whether it was Web Safety Last or The Freshman. And that was just in passing. I literally shoved the photo under his nose and he signed it and I shook his hand and that was about it. I met him later at UCLA when he came to screen some of his films at UCLA. But I really got to know him when I became friends with Richard Simonton, whose father owned Muzak for the Western United States and had a house in Toluca Lake where there was a 65-seat theater in the basement and a Wurlitzer pipe organ. And every Saturday night, they would invite people over to watch movies. And occasionally, Gaylord Carter would come over. He was a mutual friend of theirs and Harold's. And they would, screen one of Harold's films. So I had the chance to see many of them before anybody else had. People had seen Chaplin, they'd seen a lot of Keaton stuff, but they hadn't really seen much Lloyd of his features because he kept such close track of them.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of Lloyd's much for a long time. I was well-versed in Chaplin and Keaton years before I knew Lloyd, and then only through the Time Life stuff. And I was at Films Inc. in the early to mid-80s, and they had, I don't remember if they had the Time Life stuff, or if we got them. We had deals with other 16mm distributors that we would just trade back and forth, but yeah. I watched all of them.
Well, RBC had the non-theatrical rights to those. I was working for RBC. We distributed the Chaplin films non-theatrically, and Time Life had bought the Lloyd Library after Mr. Lloyd died, and the guy who made the deal was left or was ousted, and suddenly Time Life had this film library and they didn't know what to do with it. And they hired a guy named, I think it was Bob Hogue, to make the films modern so they could make money with them. And they cut them down into half-hour chunks for a TV series, and they cut the features down to versions that they thought would play better. And then they still didn't know what to do with the library, and they called us at RBC, and my boss said, do we want the Harold Lloyd Library? And I said, oh yeah, we really do, because I'd seen all the films. And I remember going over and talking to Hogue, and he was saying, oh, we got Neil Hefti to write the theme, and we're going to make it. And I said, you know, you're never going to make these films modern enough for the people who have no interest in seeing them, and the people who want to see them complete. They didn't listen to me, of course. And we got the cut versions, and they played okay, you know, but they weren't. And I remember that UCLA refused to play the Time Life versions. They wanted the versions from the Lloyd Ball, and which upset Time Life and upset the Lloyd estate. They ran, you know, the first week that we'd run the Chaplin films at Royce Hall, and they had all sold out, because at that time you hadn't been able to see Chaplin features for many years. The Lloyds had a respectable audience, but, you know, about half. The second week it was three quarters full, and the third week it was packed, and it stayed packed for the rest of the series, so the word of mouth spread.
Yeah. I sometimes think that Lloyd is my favorite of them, just in terms of sheer enjoyment. I admire Keaton more than any other filmmaker, almost, but Lloyd is just so much fun, and just so
fun.
It's so inventive. And
I mean, I think, I love Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd, I think Lloyd is a filmmaker, and, you know, he didn't take credit really for directing his films, but he was the guiding force behind them. I think he's much more dynamic and interesting filmmaker than either of the other two. You can argue which character resonates more with you than the other, but. And the other thing I love about the Lloyd stuff is so much of it shot on location. I mean,
yeah.
You get the sense of the city in the 20s.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I never get tired of. And so I always get such a kick out of going through John Bengtson's books. It's just all that location stuff is so fascinating to me.
John reminds me of an uncle-in-law of my brother in Scotland who loves the U.S. and loves New York, and he can tell you every street and every theater and every restaurant, and he's never been here, and he's afraid to come, you know. John at least comes down here from time to time, but it seems a weird obsession to live in San Francisco and scout out locations for films in Los Angeles.
You have a certain amount of distance that is probably good, you know. I've written 5 books about the Alamo, never lived in Texas, so there you go. There's no sense to some of this stuff. Did you go out to Green Acres a lot when Lloyd was alive?
A number of times. He was... got to really know him probably in late 1969, and knew him until he died, and he died in early 1971, I think. and for a lot of that period he was ill. But a lot of us were all the same age. I was Richard Symington Jr., Rich Correll, the son of Charles Correll of Ames Sandy fame, their friends, and I all sort of hung around, and we made a film. Rich directed it at Green Acres, and so I was up there, but I didn't really get into the house until after Mr. White passed away.
Is it true that he kept a Christmas tree up all year round?
The Christmas tree was up, but had been up for 7 or 8 years at that point. in some ways, I wondered if Sunset Boulevard hadn't in some way been patterned after Harold Lloyd. He was superstitious. He didn't believe in repairing anything. Fortunately, he didn't feel that way about his films. He did preserve his films. But, you know, when there was part of the coffered ceiling, little pieces would fall down, he collected them and put them in a cigar box, and the drapes were, linings were all tattered, and the furniture needed reupholstering, and it felt as if life had stopped there sometime around 1935. You didn't get that impression talking to him. He was kind of up to date and easy to talk to, and not reclusive, but I think the cost of keeping up the house was rather immense. He was, in his later years, sort of cash poor and land rich. A lot of his money had been invested in downtown real estate, and it just wasn't as valuable in the 1970s as it had been in the 1920s. And so he certainly wasn't hurting for money, but he didn't have the kind of money to keep the large staff that he once had for the estate.
Yeah, it was a huge place.
It was immense.
I can't remember off the top of my head. Did his wife, Mildred, outlive him? Or?
No, she passed away a year or so before he did.
Did you ever meet her?
I never met her. I was at her funeral. But I never met her. She was somewhat reclusive.
She never acted again after they married, did she?
I don't think so. Or if she did, just, you know, once or twice.
That's always seemed a shame to me. I guess people did and do that, get married and retire and just become the housewife or whatever. But she was a delightful presence on screen, and I always liked the films that she and Harold did together.
Well, it's one of my interests is, you know, what did people do after they stopped making movies? Because, you know, life goes on and you can't just, you know, live on your laurels. And I'm always fascinated at the different areas that people went into to, you know, after their on-screen careers ended.
I don't even know what Lloyd did. I know he had the photography hobby, but he didn't really ever try to make a living doing that, did he?
He remained active longer than people think. I mean, he had a radio show. He invested in KMPC. He had made a film with Howard Hughes in 1945 that ended up really getting released in 1950. He also did at least one screen test for a TV show. I think he could have continued acting if he wanted to do that, but he'd always been in charge, you know, and I don't think he had any interest in not being in charge, and he had no interest in, as many stars do, they didn't want to destroy the illusion they'd created.
Yeah, it does seem he could have just started producing films or even directing them.
Well, he did that. I mean, he produced several films at RKO. He tried to make Kay Kaiser into a new Harold Lloyd. I think his, and this goes back to his being able to objectify the character, I think he always had in mind that he could create another Harold Lloyd, and tried to do that several times by, you know, producing or, you know, but it, ultimately it wasn't as satisfying for him.
Yeah. Let's switch over to Tom Mix. Now, you said that you collected some of his films early on. When did that become something that you really wanted to pursue enough to write a book about him?
As I say, I met Sid Jordan, who was one of Tom's friends, and Sid and his wife generously gave me a number of stills, and so I started collecting stills. I go to Larry Edmonds bookstore and Collector's Bookstore, and whenever I had a little extra money, I would haunt the stores and the mail order things and buy stills. In large part because you couldn't see the films. I mean, everybody said Tom Mix was great, but really what was available at the time were his Selig films that were rather primitive and not anything that would lead you to believe that this was the greatest cowboy star of all time. Sam Rubin, who edited in those days the 8mm and 16mm Collector and later Classic Images, loaned me a print of Sky High that he'd acquired from the Museum of Modern Art. And so that was the first of his later Fox films that I saw. I was interested, as many kids are, or people who become enthusiastic thinking that there should be a book. And I met my friend Bob Pillow, who was a Western fan, much older guy. He'd come out here in 1930, wanted to get into the movies, and he did one picture, a crowd scene in a Buck Jones film, and ended up working for the Department of Water and Power, but he remained a fan all of his life. And he introduced me to Raymond Lee, who was a child actor in the 20s and had gone on to become a film historian. And Raymond had a deal with a publisher, and he sold a dozen books, and he was looking for more projects. And we met through Bob Pillow, and we were going to collaborate on a book. And at the time, I had, you know, I was 18 years old. I had no credibility as a writer. And so Raymond did the treatment without really showing it to me and set it off to his publisher. His publisher had a number of his books in the hopper, and they didn't want to buy another one until they published the backlog. So in that sense, I was disappointed, but it was also a blessing. In the meantime, I had taken a college essay about an old cowboy that I knew and sent it into a Western magazine and sold it for a magnificent $20. And so I was now a professional author and able to stand toe-to-toe with Raymond, or so I thought. And so anyway, that didn't come across then. And years later, I still had this interest, and my friend Packy Smith, who had a company called Riverwood Press, said, "I need a book in 6 months." And Ed Hulse had an idea to do the book on Betty Grable, and I had the idea to do the book on Tom Mix, and I finished mine first, and it got published. The odd thing is, after the King Cowboy Tom Mix in the movies was published, I was going through some old files and found the original outline that I'd done with Raymond years ago, and it pretty much followed the same outline, but I'd totally forgotten the contents of the outline, so it must have been buried in the back of my brain.
That's a good book. And what is it about Mix that attracted you to begin with, as opposed to, say, William S. Hart?
When I first got interested in movies, my parents bought me an 8mm projector, a silent projector, and they bought me a collection of 50-foot subjects, and among them were newsreels of planes flying in World War II, and Billy Dooley doing his goofy gob thing, and an excerpt from Dusty Rides Again with Tom Mix. So again, the reinforcement of I'd always been interested in Westerns since I was a kid, you know, watching Gene Autry and Roy Rogers on TV. The notion that Tom Mix was the greatest cowboy star of all appealed to me. And then access to these people that have known him. Not only Sid Jordan, but Gypsy Joe Bowers, later Al Rogel, the director, and several others. And so I, Ted French, and they all spoke well of him and spoke of his daring, his willingness to do stunts that nobody else would do. And gradually, as the films became not so much available, but at least seeable, in the late 60s, I was still a student at UCLA. I met Alex Gordon, who at the time was doing the Fox preservation program. They had found a bunch of films in the Fox vaults, going back to the silent era. And Fox had always been a studio that most of the pre-1935 product was banished because of the fire in 1937. And Alex gave me a job of patching the sprocket holes, damaged sprocket holes, on which I did at home. But and I got to see a number of the films from that. And I was very fortunate, or unfortunate, depending on how you look at it. I misspent a great deal of my youth between being involved in patching these old films, and then the Simontons were involved with UCLA and the American Film Institute in the early years. And so when the Paramount collection went to UCLA and Paramount Silence went to the American Film Institute, we'd screen them in the basement of the Simonton home. And for a number of years, I literally was over there every night of the week, you know, not just Saturday nights, but every night of the week, and we'd just see whatever the next two pictures on the shelf were. You know, we'd go down to the vault, pull them out, watch them, and then do it again the next night. So it was a liberal education in at least the films of Fox and Paramount. I was doing oral histories at the American Film Institute, and so got to see a bunch of stuff there and met, you know, there's a lot of, you asked if I'd interviewed some of these people, a lot of these people I met in social situations or in situations where it didn't seem appropriate to hit them up for an interview. And I regret it now. I mean, I met Crane Wilbur, for example, from The Perils of Pauline.
Sure.
And I would have loved to have talked to him, but I didn't. You know, I was given a lot of stuff as a young person from people who worked in the business. And then there's other times where I interviewed Virgil Miller, the cameraman, and he had saved all of his stills and memorabilia, and he had a new wife, and she said, "Get that stuff out of the house." I was all in the garage, and he took me out there and said, "Would you like to have this stuff?" And the answer was yes, I really want it, but it meant so much to him, I just couldn't bring myself to take it, and I'm sorry I did, because she probably threw it away the minute he died, you know.
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
Ever since then, I've taken anything anybody will give me, and I've never turned down a free meal.
I only became aware of his work much later, because he was another one of those people that I found it very hard to find his films for the longest time. And even now.
Yeah, it's possible to see them in some archives. His sound films are a little more accessible. There's bootleg tapes and DVDs out there, but they haven't really been made available in any kind of commercial way that make them easily accessible. Part of it is he only made 10 talkies, and so there's not much interest in silent films. In a commercial way. And part of what makes stuff appealing, I think, is a certain familiarity. And, you know, like Harold Lloyd, people were familiar with Chaplin, even if they couldn't see his feature films. The Mutuals and the Keystones and the SMAs were out there to be seen. With Buster Keaton, enough of his films were public domain that you could see some of the best of Keaton, and he was still working, so you could see him on TV. with Lloyd, he essentially vanished when he stopped making movies, and Nixon was the same way. There, his, except for the few talkies, none of his stuff ever got to TV, and so there wasn't clamoring to see the stuff.
Yeah, in terms of silent cowboys, I'm much better versed in William S. Hart than in Tom Mix. Just because the film seemed to be more accessible.
Well, and growing up out here, I was familiar with William S. Hart, too, because my mother took me up to the ranch when it opened in 58 or 59. It had been in limbo since he passed away, and finally was settled, and the county opened it as a park. My mother had actually worked for the attorney who represented William S. Hart Jr. trying to break his father's will and get his father's estate. But so I was familiar with Hart. I'd seen Tumbleweeds and Hell's Hinges. And, you know, I was somewhat familiar with some of the other cowboy stars, especially because a lot of them were public domain and there were 8mm prints floating around. And so I'd see stuff. But, you know, the mixed stuff was always elusive because everybody said he was the best, and you just couldn't tell until it was... And even now, I mean, he made some 85 pictures for Fox, and really somewhere between a dozen and 20 of them survived complete and in really viewable condition.
Yeah, it seems odd because he was so huge during his career.
Well, and a lot of the Tom Mix fans that I knew really didn't know anything about Tom Mix, the movie star. They knew Tom Mix through the radio show, the Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters, which Tom Mix lent his name to but never appeared on.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I had this interest. In part, you know, as I met and got to know these people who worked in pictures, it occurred to me that they thought they were doing important work that would live forever, and then, you know, features came along and the shorts were eliminated and sound came along and people forgot the silent pictures and color came along and everybody forgot the black and white pictures. A lot of these people were very, very defensive of their careers. They just didn't believe at the end of the day that it was had been that important or that worthwhile. And I always thought it was sad that here you had the prospect of stuff that would last forever, and yet, you know, it really didn't. You know, within a few years, most of it was gone.
Was it Sarah Bernhardt who said, "I rely on these films to make me immortal"?
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't quite work out.
It didn't quite work out, and in fact, you know, the few clips that you usually see of Queen Elizabeth from 1912 do the exact opposite. You don't have any sense of what she must have been on stage. And that's another aspect of film that is one of those eternal mysteries. You know, the camera loves some people and it doesn't others. And why that is, I don't know.
Why people keep arguing about who is actually a good actor and who's a good movie star. And if you're one, you can't be the other. But I think in many cases, I think you can. I mean, you know, Cary Grant, I think, is one of the great actors. But even if he wasn't, he would still be Cary Grant.
Yes. It's hard to say. Would Cary Grant have worked as well on stage? I don't know. I remember as a kid seeing films of Gary Cooper on TV and thinking, I mean, he's kind of stiff. As I grew older, I began to appreciate what he was doing. And a few years ago, we ran The Westerner for some young people who've never heard of Gary Cooper, let alone seen anything, and they were just mesmerized. And, you know, directors would say, well, you know, when you're sitting there on the stage, it looks like he's doing nothing, and then when he gets up on the screen, it's magic. And having worked in films and being an editor, I've seen the same thing. I've seen people that are on the soundstage just have no charisma at all, and seem to be terrible at reading a line, and somehow on camera it works.
Yeah.
And you know, whether Cary Grant could have taken that, or Gary Cooper, either that star quality and translated to stage, I don't know. I saw Gloria Swanson on stage in later years, and, you know, all I can say is I saw Gloria Swanson on stage. She wasn't anything particularly interesting. I saw Henry Fonda on stage, and he'd certainly been a stage actor, but he didn't have anywhere near the appeal that he had on screen. And again, he was older, it's hard to judge, but, you know, there are people, the other extreme would be somebody like Catherine Dale Owen. I've always thought that the reason that John Gilbert's career failed with His Glorious Night was the horrible direction of Lionel Barrymore, but more to the point, Catherine Dale Owen, the leading lady, played everything front. She never looked her lover in the eye, and
sure,
it looked like he needed Listerine, you know, and it eliminated a lot of his appeal. And she was, you know, had some kind of a stage career and had, you know, some kind of a film career, but it's easy to see why she didn't have much of a film career.
Last week, a couple of weeks ago, we screened Young Eagles, the Wellman film from 1930, and Jean Arthur is in it. She's, I won't say awful, but she's, if you watch that, you would never think that she would become Jean Arthur. Whereas, every time Virginia Bruce walks onto the screen, you think, holy cow, look at this. She's, she's gorgeous, she's got charisma, but she never became anything like a Jean Arthur in terms of stardom.
Well, one of the people that I find most fascinating is somebody like Cary Grant, whose first starring film in 1932, and the title escapes me at the moment, he's Cary Grant. And then for the next 2 or 3 years, he's this kind of stiff, awkward guy who looks like Cary Grant, but he, you know, and why that happened... Frank Tuttle was maybe a more perceptive director. Maybe Grant got more self-conscious. Who knows?
Yeah.
But that, you know, I mean, you look at other stars like Burns and Allen, and in their early shorts, Burns is kind of nasty and not very appealing, and not that kind of interesting, folksy guy that he became later on. So he evolved through the years. But then there's people like Edgar Bergen, and his shorts from 1929, he's every bit as good as he was later on. And so how that happens, that maturing of talent, who knows? Maybe it's as simple as getting the right costume or the right hairstyle or the right, right craft service person to cater to your needs on the stage. I don't know.
It's also one of the fun things about exploring film history, because you do get to see the genesis and then the evolution of all these people. I always think Jack Benny is one of the most interesting examples of this, because I revere Jack Benny. And I just think he's one of the funniest humans who ever lived. But he did not come out of the gate being Jack Benny, not by a long shot.
Well, what's always surprised me about Jack Benny, I mean, you look at his early films where he'd been an MC in vaudeville, and there's just nothing appealing about
him. No.
He was on radio.
He's very snide,
And I don't know how he maintained his ability to attract an audience in radio through the 30s.
No.
And oddly enough, the Jack Benny we know and love really doesn't emerge until about 1943, and the film Buck Benny Rides Again really points the way to that before he was ever that on radio. It's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, I've been listening. I have a whole lot of Jack Benny recorded. And the 30s stuff is sometimes interesting, but it's almost never funny. Mm-hmm. Whereas, say, 1947, to pick a particularly rich year, is just great. Every single episode of that radio show is just phenomenal.
And which I guess gives you, you know, a reason why you should let shows mature. you know, where you cancel something after first two episodes, you may be missing out on something.
And as you were saying about George Burns, he evolved slowly, but Gracie didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You look at her right from the start, and she's right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's really interesting to watch these things. Wings, of course, was restored, the first Academy Award winner, for the two listeners who don't know what that is. It was restored earlier this year, and I went to several screenings of it here and there. And almost every time with a big audience, the first time Gary Cooper walks in, there's a gasp. I mean, people look at him and think, wow, look at this guy. And he's already bang. Mm-hmm. He's Gary Cooper from the first second you see him.
Yeah, but that can happen even with lesser stars. Follow Through, the two-color Technicolor film from 1930, this car drives up, and Nancy Carroll stands up and gets out, and they cut to a close-up of her, and the audience gasps. It's just...
She's one of those people I can't quite understand, except just for the vagaries of what people see and what they don't, why she isn't better appreciated, because she was just terrific.
Well, she herself later on said that she was a bit of a pill. She became a prima donna.
I've heard that.
And it's difficult.
But you'd never know it from seeing the
films. But she apparently nastied herself out of her Paramount contract and ended up at Columbia and felt that she wasn't getting what she deserved, and the studio felt the same way, and she was... You know, by the mid-30s, she was history, and she worked in stage and came to a realization that she'd been a pill and was the architect of her own demise in films. But, you know, that can happen. I don't understand why Helen Twelvetrees wasn't a bigger star.
I agree.
Sensational.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, she's... I thought about her earlier in this conversation because... When I was a kid, and I grew up in the opposite circumstances that you did in terms of film appreciation, grew up in rural South Carolina, no chance to see anything except what happened to show up on television. But for whatever reason, from the earliest childhood, I loved the past, and I loved listening to my grandmother tell me stories about when she was a kid and that sort of thing. And so anytime a movie came on, just its age was enough to get me to watch it. And for some reason, when my grandmother in Aiken, South Carolina, Helen Twelvetrees movies would show up on television regularly. And so I probably became better aware of Helen Twelvetrees as a child than, you know, I wouldn't have known Jean Arthur if you threw her at me. But Helen Twelvetrees, I knew quite well. Terrific. Nobody knows who Helen Twelvetrees is now. Nobody does. Her life, her career just didn't... I mean, the films just don't live for some reason. And it's just, it's really sad.
Well, you're talking about going to see anything you could see. And I experienced that, too. As I, you know, in the mid-70s, so this is about the time when I had wheels for the first time and could get around... there was that tipping point year, 1976, as I recall, where the first two words of any title of any television series were in color. Suddenly, except for a few local stations, there were no black and white movies on TV anymore, and no older movies. Then, a little later, when they relaxed the prohibition against half-hour commercials... and late night got taken over by infomercials. But there's no old movies on TV anymore, except in the old movie ghettos of turn classic movies. But in 1966, they ran a series of musicals one summer at UCLA, and I went mainly because they were old. You know, they were a Broadway Melody and Show of Shows, and I would drive out an hour each way to see these films. And I'd never been a musical fan. I'd watched musicals on TV, and I always thought they were phony, and you know, you could tell that the recordings were not live. And seeing these films at UCLA didn't enhance my opinion. Broadway Melody, I had never seen any really early talkies before, except clips. And I was just my jaw dropped to the floor. And show of shows, I mean, did anybody actually sit through these things? And then the second or third week, Bob Epstein had programmed this thing and ran Love Me Tonight. And that was a revelation to me that, you know, oh, gee, musicals aren't supposed to be realistic. There's, you know, something more going on here. And one of the things I love, William Drew mentions this in his new D.W. Griffith book. I mean, I had the idea long before I read it in his book, The Unpredictable Past. I think when you know, you grow up with a certain pat story about the past. I remember as a kid, hearing about how salacious F. Scott Fitzgerald was and how, you know, children shouldn't read him. And then reading the stories, it's like, you know, did anybody ever read this stuff? You know, they're very sweet and very, very fine writing. And there's the same kind of thing. I remember the minister at our church had been a musician in the 20s. He'd started as one of the Art Hickman bands and played clarinet and saxophone. He later worked with Phil Harris and was on the Jack Benny show. And he came over to the house one day, and I'd had this album of Enoch Light and the Light Brigade, you know, recordings of 20s music made in the early 60s. And my mother, for some reason, because he'd been a musician, said, you should listen to this. It sounds just like the 20s. And he said, he listened to it. He said, no, it doesn't sound like the 20s at all. And he said, because it doesn't have, it has the, you know, the trap cymbal, which we didn't really have until 1931. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, what you know about the past is shifted. I remember watching a documentary on, I think it may be on the Chicago DVD, and about flappers in the 20s. And one of the women said, we had these long coats that didn't have buttons on them, and we would always hold them. And God forbid that the bottom edges be even. They had to be uneven. That was the style. Who knew? You know, sure. You might see it, but you wouldn't understand the, like any fad, you just wouldn't understand it unless you lived through it. Well, that's why these things look so ancient when they first came to TV, is nobody had ever been able to look at the past before. I mean, there were occasional reissues, but they, you know, they weren't of any consequence. And, you know, suddenly seeing a film from 1929 or 1930 with women in these form-fitting dresses and no bras, which it just looked bizarre. And the surviving architecture, you know, the Art Moderne, the curved corners and things like that, people were busy covering it up with aluminum siding to make it look modern. And I think the movies, but more so television, has made it possible to not have that sense of, gee, weren't they strange back then? Because now you can wear anything and nobody bats an eyelash. And again, because of TV and radio, the Beatles, who are coming up on, you know, 50 years, hard to believe. But kids today will listen. Where they, you know, when, in our age, we were freaks if we were looking at a movie that was 30 years old. I mean, part of it's technology. The recording quality is sufficiently decent that it travels 50 years, whereas recordings from 1916 were commercially unacceptable on radio. And except, I remember another influence as a kid was radio show out here, Andy and Virginia Mansfield, Turn Back the Clock. They would play a new recording of an older song, and then they would follow it up with the original recording, you know, and they might play an acoustic record from the teams. That was interesting. I mean, one of the things that I find appealing is, in studying film and popular culture, is I get to live in a broader span of time.
Yes.
And I don't have this sense of I wake up in the morning and my knees ache. I get a sense of it, but I don't have the same sense that some people do of God, life's passing me by and I'm getting old, and you know, because I have a broader perspective, I think.
I'm always a little puzzled when people don't accept anything outside of their own lifetime, which you hear a lot these days, because you think it's like having the entire world given to you, and you just say, no, I just want to stay on this street. And
well, I mean, having been part of the Twist generation, I certainly understand the appeal of living in the moment.
Well, sure.
When all your friends are doing it, it's hard to be on the outside. I'm sure people, you know, behind their backs are saying, that weirdo over there, you know, I think to a certain extent, I mean, it can happen at any time, but there's got to be a way in. And I think with you and with me, we were young enough and impressionable enough that the stuff seemed interesting and not just odd.
Yeah.
I remember teaching a class at UCLA Extension on understanding film, and there was this guy, and I didn't know his name, but he was sitting there in the class 2-3 weeks. Just from the look on his face, I could tell he hated everything I was running. Just, you know, I later learned that he had won a class and so understanding film, that sounds nice, so I'll drink that. And he was all set to trade this in for another class because he was hating every minute of it. And then I ran a piece of The Scarlet Empress, the scene where Sam Jaffe is drilling through the wall,
yes,
to spy on his wife, and the drill bit comes out through the eye of the painting, and it looks like a Dolly painting come to life.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, this guy got it and loved the rest of the class. But, you know, it was the way in. You know, I don't know what that way in is for anybody.
It's a fluke. It's always a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was a kid and watching Castle films and Black Hawk films that I got out of the library, because it was a miracle to find that we had an 8mm projector and we could actually get these movies, but I didn't know a single friend who wanted to watch these things with me. So whatever it worked for me, whatever doorway I found into this, it was not a similar doorway to anybody else I knew.
Well, and I remember, you know, loving the Hal Roach, Laurel Hardy, and our gang films on TV as a kid. And in the probably mid-80s sometime, I was at an awards dinner of some kind. And Abe Most, who been a big band musician and now had his own band, was playing for events. His band played one of the Hal Roach themes, and I went up to him between sets and said, "What is that?" You know, because and he said, "Oh, I don't know. We've just had it in the charts for years." but it made an impression on me. And, I mean, I have the kind of mind where I can remember the release year of any film I've ever seen in a book. Is that of any value? No. It's just, you know, I mean,
just the way your mind works.
Yeah, it's just the way my mind works, or doesn't work, or malfunctions, how you look at it.
I've always loved your DeMille book. As a matter of fact, I read it, and it was, you know, in typescript. And that's not a book that would ever have occurred to me to write, because I always feel like those are the people that books have already been written about, and what's the point, and yet you found a fresh way in. So what was the inspiration for that book?
Well, it was kind of roundabout. Mark Wanamaker took me up to the DeMille estate in 1985 or so. At that time, it was, the house was still Liz DeMille had left when he passed away. His suits were still in the closet. They still put a rose on his desk every morning. A lot of the memorabilia had been given to the Brigham Young University and the Academy, and The silent films, at least, had gone to the George Eastman House for storage and preservation. Helen Cohen, who ran the estate, mentioned that they were getting ready to sell the house. The family was, they'd had enough. They wanted their share of the estate. And so they needed an inventory of the films that were still in the vault, and I volunteered to do that. And as a result, I got to see the 16-millimeter prints that the Eastman House had sent back of all of DeMille's silent films. And I was not a particular DeMille fan. I remember seeing The Road to Yesterday at the Silent Movie Theater and thinking it was one of the worst films I'd ever seen. I did like The King of Kings. I liked Cleopatra. I liked Four Frightened People. I remember working in a movie theater running a reissue of The Ten Commandments, thinking it's a picture I'd always wanted to see, and I'd come back on my day off and sit and watch it, and I'd go in and see 10 minutes at a time, and I thought the performances were stilted, and so I was not a particular DeMille fan, but in seeing these films, I'm not even sure my opinion changed that much until toward the very end when I saw The Golden Chance. It's a film from 1916 that virtually nobody's heard of, although it is available on DVD now. And it was like having seen Love Me Tonight. It was one of those light turning on moments. When I realized that DeMille was perfectly capable of making a subdued chamber drama, realistic, and that he chose to work in this grand manner that became his style. Anyway, I had seen most everything DeMille had made, and Richard Kozarski, who was then with the Museum of the Moving Image in New York, was getting ready to put on the first complete DeMille retrospective. And I'd known Richard for years, and he knew I'd seen the films, and because I'd seen the films, he asked me to write the program notes. So I wrote the program notes, a page and a half, and when the series was over, I thought, well, I've got this stuff, and I could put in some pictures, and I have an instant book. Expand it a little bit. And so I started doing a little more research, and Betty Lasky gave me Xeroxes of a bunch of early documents. And I've always been interested in primary source materials, because I did a lot of interviews with people through the years, and I've always found not that people lie, but they don't remember in chronology.
Sure.
They tend to be self-serving. They don't know all the sides of the story, so they're only telling you their version. They want to please, so they tell you what they think you want to hear. And here was this primary source material, day by day practice. And so that led me to begin the book. And, frankly, it was well received, but when I first started circulating it, the reaction that I got was, well, this should be two different books. It should be a biography and a separate filmography. And I had no interest in doing that because I'd already written it. And there was already a Films of Cecil B. DeMille, and there had been other biographies. But at the same time, I was aware that I'd never seen a book like this before. It's the book I wanted to write, it's the book I wanted to read, but it's not something that... It's like John Bengtson's books, he sent me the treatise on the first one, and I thought, who's going to want to see this, But it's totally unnecessary until you read it and you say, wow.
How did we live without this?
Yeah. And I don't want to pat myself on the back like that, but I think DeMille was such a controversial figure in his life, and a lot of what had been written about him was polarized for that reason. They condemned him for his political stances. And even doing the research, though, I was not won over immediately. The thing that changed my mind about DeMille was here he is in 1932. He basically can't get a job in Hollywood. His career is essentially over. He has some money left over from an income tax settlement. He goes to Jesse Lasky, and they make a deal to make the Sign of the Cross. And DeMille fully believed it would be a one-picture deal, and that would be it. before the picture gets into production, Jesse Lasky's fired, B.P. Schulberg is also fired, and Adolf Zukor is now the, literally the king of the studio, and he and DeMille had not been on friendly relations when DeMille had been at Paramount before. So here at this precarious moment in his career, DeMille has promised a number of extras that they're going to get work in his picture, and he finds out that the casting department isn't calling them, and he takes a stand and says, call my people, I'm not going to work tomorrow. That's kind of gutsy, and it's sort of erases the notion that he was this autocratic, uncaring character. I hope that I was true to the material, because most of the book is based on documents rather than interviews. There's a few interview things, but I think it created a more rounded picture of DeMille, at least in his working life, than had been available before.
Just taking it film by film, you get a much fuller picture of how his career went, and not taking each film as an entity in and of itself, but as part of the arc of his...
And that was part of the thing. I mean, that shows the origin of the program notes, that it was film by film. But I wove, I hope, a continuing narrative through that. And each, although it's each title is represented, it's also what else is going on in his life and in Hollywood at the time. And different films are approached in different ways. So this chapter on The Buccaneer is about the 15-year gestation period of the script. And I think Northwest Mounted Police is about Technicolor and the problems of shooting with Technicolor. And I think it gives a sense of DeMille's career and his life, his working relations, and why he was the king of Hollywood at the time, even though he's largely forgotten today. I even had to tell the other night, we had a program at the Barn with Paramount presenting a thing from their archive, and two of their people got up and referred to Cecil B. DeMille, and I had to say, please, 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 Cecil B. DeMille. So in some ways he's forgotten, but I think the book gives not just DeMille's career, but it gives a broader sense of how movies were actually made during the period from 1913 to 1951.
He does live on as kind of a trademark more than a filmmaker these days, because I think many people know the name and know that it means bigger than life entertainment, and I've found watching his silent films to be pretty revelatory, because most of his sound stuff I just don't care for much at all. I know many people love Ten Commandments, but it just seems so overbaked to me, and the dialogue is so phony, and it just seems like a concoction to me.
Well, I felt the same way. I mean, I remember when I was working in the theaters, I would see chunks of it, and I'd say, these performances because of the dialogue. But I'd see people coming out of the theater and with this beatific...
Oh, people love that movie,
And I have to say that, in my maturity or dotage, depending on how you look at it, I admire the film. It's practically 4 hours long, and you're never bored. It's over the top, but it's fun over the top. And it works... I find that DeMille's films work on several levels. They sort of play to the bourgeoisie, and they play to the higher intellect, too, if you bother to go beyond that edge. But I would say that the bulk of his greatest influence was in the silent period. And the other thing about DeMille, I think, is that, D.W. Griffith and all this, but it was really DeMille's technique that was absorbed by Hollywood, and so much of what was innovative in his work became absorbed that it doesn't have the same revolutionary aspect that it did when it was made.
Yeah, you can draw a straight line from DeMille to Steven Spielberg to name a popular director in a way that you can't draw a line from Griffith to Spielberg.
I grew up with the Griffith mythos, and I remember interviewing Irvin Willett, and I asked him, what directors influenced him. He said, "Well, I really liked D.W. Griffith." He said he could shoot a scene better than anybody, but he couldn't make a movie. And at the time, I thought, I was, in my early 20s, I thought he was being somewhat sacrilegious, but I think it was very perceptive, certainly Griffith made some great movies, but when you go back and look at it, there's a lot more of pieces and moments than there are films that you really love.
I mentioned you in the conversation I was having recently with somebody about Kevin Brownlow's Cinema Europe, because I remember the first time I watched that, especially the one on Scandinavian film, all that stuff looks wonderful. It just looks wonderful. This is a fascinating episode. And I remember I was talking to you about it at the time. This has been 12, 15 years ago, I guess. And you said, "Yeah, Kevin really knows how to pick the clips." And it's probably the same way. You could go through Griffith's stuff and pick out individual moments, and if you want to present him as the greatest filmmaker who ever lived, I think you could probably make a case for it.
Mm-hmm.
But watching the films themselves is a different proposition. But DeMille, he always had his finger on the public pulse, and they always seem to play, and I can see why they do. And I know people who just revere the Ten Commandments and think it's one of the really classic movies with no sense of irony to that. but Greatest Show on Earth and a few of those I have very short patience with. But the silent stuff and the early 30s, I think Sign of the Cross is terrific. And I always remember Charlie Barton, who was assistant director on Four Frightened People. I asked him about that, and he said, "Hell, everybody was frightened on that picture."
Well, it was one of his few flops. I mean, the other thing about DeMille was that, out of 70 films that he personally directed, 65 of them were highly successful. Only a handful lost money.
Yeah.
Four Frightened People, again, I think it's how you perceive it. It's this stupid melodrama with these overwrought performances, if you look at it that way. But it's really a social comedy, with the ground down teaching the natives the virtues of birth control, I came to realize that there was more going on in DeMille's films. And, a lot of times, too, the sound films, especially after 1940, I think he begins repeating himself then, and the films aren't as interesting. But DeMille himself was such a huge star on his own, probably the only filmmaker known as a household name, because he'd been the host of the Lux Radio Theater.
Sure.
And if DeMille had a failing, I think it was the notion, and it's really a 19th century notion, and he was really a Victorian in his upbringing and his outlook, was that great films come from great subjects. And the presenting the Ten Commandments is, makes it a great film, whether it lives up as drama or not. It's interesting, I had seen the film and had it on tape with Gaylord Carter's score, and Gaylord, for all of his virtues as a film accompanist, he could accompany some things better than others. He was better with comedy and light drama than he was with, heavy drama. And he tended to play Ten Commandments kind of balls to the wall, and it's a little exhausting. When they reopened the Egyptian Theater here in Hollywood, Gillian Anderson, the musicologist, not the actress, resurrected the Hugo Riesenfeld score for the original New York presentation of the Ten Commandments. It was the single best silent film score I've ever heard. And it's much more subtle. When the thing transitions from the ancient story to the modern story. Jeannie McPherson talks about the mother not being this kind of brass-bound character, but between her performance and the subtitle, she comes across as kind of this unbending force. But in the Riesenfeld score, they're playing Dewdrops, which is the music that they use in the barbershop sunrise, either the barbershop or the photo scene. It's very light, and it gives that second half a chance to build so that you're not at that intensity all the way to the end. And
yeah.
It was a revelation. It worked in a way that it never worked for me before.
All of DeMille's stuff seems to be available on DVD and...
a lot of it.
At least the sound films. I wonder why he's kind of drifted into the background as he seems to have.
Well, I think in part because of... You know, in part because of changing taste, but also because of his political taintedness from the McCarthy era. And that's interesting, too, because the thing that he's most reviled for, having stood up in front of the Directors Guild and pronounced the names of Billy Wilder and William Wyler as Billy Wilder and William Wyler, and putting a heavily Eastern European accent to his... Never happened. I mean, the meeting happened, and John Ford did get up and say, "I'm John Ford, I make westerns." But in fact, DeMille didn't mispronounce the names because it was against the rules of the meeting to mention anybody by name, and to avoid personalities, I think. The issue that was at hand was not the loyalty oath, but whether Joseph Mankiewicz had spoken out of turn without permission from the board. And that issue had been resolved by the time of the meeting. And in fact, at one point, Delmer Daves gets up and says, according to the transcript, "You called the board crazy." And DeMille says, "No, I didn't call the board crazy. I said they'd be crazy if they enacted this loyalty oath for all the members," which strongly suggests that he wasn't even personally in favor of a loyalty oath for all the members. So I think, although there had been books written about DeMille as late as the 1970s, it became the mainstream film critics, which had dismissed him for his political thing, and the films not being of the quality of a Lubitsch or a Ford. The only other book I think that had been written recently before mine was Sumiko Higashi's book on DeMille's silent films, which is a much more scholarly type of thing. I'm a strong believer that, I know I'm writing to a niche audience, but I hope that if somebody by chance picks up one of my works, that they'll be able to read it and understand it without having to sit with their Webster's on a bridge in their lap.
I have the same misguided hope in my books, too. And if anybody ever does read one, I think they'll find that's true.
Well, I'm sure you're in the same boat that I am. I mean, I don't really care whether people read them, although it soothes my ego when somebody says, "I really liked your book." I want them to buy them.
Sure.
And what they do with them is up to
them. They can buy them by the gross and build something with them. That would be fine with me.
I'm sure that some of mine are hanging in outhouses, even as we speak.
Well, we should probably wrap it up. I will have links to your books, not only those books, but the others that we haven't even spoken about. We should have talked about Flying A. We'll just have to do this again. We have many, many other things to talk about. So, Bob Burchard, thank you very much for being here.
You know, I was thinking just the other day that it speaks well of the people that I've lined up for the commentary track so far, that at the end of every interview so far, I believe, I've said to them, "We should do this again." And I really mean it. I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. Everybody that I've talked to so far has at least another commentary track's worth of fun conversation in them. And Bob is certainly no exception. There's a lot of stuff, including a really interesting project that he's been working on for a long time that we didn't even get to. So Bob will definitely be back. What I'm thinking is he'll probably come back sometime in the late summer so we can discuss Cinecon, of which he is one of the head honchos. And he can give us all the inside dope on Cinecon, show us where all the bodies are buried. And oddly enough, there are some bodies buried at Cinecon. I can't go into it more than that. There's this legal things. But let me thank all the people who had a hand in making this commentary track another award-winning effort, or let's say an award-deserving effort. What do you think? It deserves awards for everything except sound recording. I'm the first to admit that. I'm so sorry. But I'm getting better. I'm going to get better. Believe me. I can change. Don't throw me out. I can change. I can be better. And speaking of begging like that I can be better, I first want to thank my wife, Claire McCullough, who is not only a wonderful wife, but a wonderful announcer. And I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my personal website, frankthompson.tv, and the commentary track website, which is thecommentarytrack.com. You want to put those three W's before all of this stuff. Please go to thecommentarytrack.com or my personal website. Order books, order videos when you do. If there are books that I have in stock, order them directly from me through PayPal, and I will autograph them for you if you want me to. And if I don't have them in stock, order them from Amazon through the links on either page, and then I'll get a little bit of a kickback from those sales, and it won't cost you one extra penny. Come on, that's a deal. I get money. You don't even spend money. That's win-win. Come on. Also want to thank, of course, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my beautiful theme music. Rob is also one of the two composers who has worked on my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. And I'm going to be doing a little bit more about that in an upcoming episode, closer to when it actually has a street date. I'm not quite sure when that's going to be. But it's getting there. It's getting there. I know I keep saying this month after month, but it is nearly finished. And in fact, this week, Thanksgiving week, depending on when you're listening to this, I'm going up country, and after I play a gig or two with Canned Heat, as you would think, then I'm going to show the rough cut, and I hope it's not that rough, rough cut of the documentary to my last surviving cast member of the actual parody of Beaugest, Nord Whited, who is a wonderful, wonderful man, and I'm so looking forward to sitting down and finally showing him this documentary that I've been bugging him about for the last 3 or 4 years. And now that we're finally almost there, I'm just tickled pink to think that we'll finally get up there. So thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for the music. And thanks to everybody who listens. And more than thanks to everybody who goes to iTunes and leaves me a good review and a 5-star rating. And if you don't have something nice to say it on somebody else's podcast, would you? I need the good stuff. I need the high ratings. We want to attract more people to this podcast, and that's the best way we can do it, is to have high ratings on iTunes so that you can get people to think, commentary track, eh? What is this? It sounds intriguing, but is it? It's got nothing but 5-star ratings. It must be great. And so they'll come and listen, and then they'll find out that it is great, because it is great. So thank you very much. Going to see you next week when I'm really, talk about tickled pink. I've already said that once. I'm tickled even pinker to say that my guest next week is the great L.Q. Jones. And I believe it's going to be the first of a 2-part interview, because my session with him went well over 2 hours, and I figure I should probably break that up just to have mercy on my poor listeners. So this is a really, really, really big deal for me to talk with a guy who is actually in The Wild Bunch. If not my favorite film, one of my favorite films. It's in the top 2. So this is great. It's going to be on next week, L.Q. Jones. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We're going to fix it in post.